Jai Guru, everyone.
Jai Guru.
And welcome to this episode of Yogananda podcast. We have the three musketeers today. We're minus one, fourth musketeer, Lauren, today. She will be with us next time, I'm sure. But today it is the three of us and Priyank. His lovely face. Don't worry for any viewers on YouTube. He is not frozen. It's unfortunately his camera is live. You can see his wonderful face on his picture, but he is with us. In whereabouts are you, Priyank, in the world?
A stone's throw away from Babaji's cave in Dwarahat Ashram.
Awesome.
I've snuck into the reading. Snuck into the reading room illegally. So
if I get say that.
If I get caught out and you're like, I have to carry one without me.
You hear you screaming, yes. We'll know what has happened, but yeah, bring that energy from Babaji's cave into the conversation today. And wonderful to start a new chapter. So we finished up the chapter 10 in the previous episode. And that was a really, really nice chapter, wasn't it? It felt like a very, not that the others aren't, but a very momentous chapter. Guruji finally met, came face to face in person with his Gurudeva, as he says, his master, Sri Yukteswar. And we unpack that line for line, and we're going to go through this chapter. And it's a fun chapter, isn't it? It's, read it through fresh again for the migrations, our work here. And it just made me smile sort of from beginning to end. It was a really fun, read. I forgot how inspiring I think it was for me, the two penniless boys in Brindaban. So my impression was definitely one of inspiration and faith, the strength of faith. What about you guys? Did you have any sort of lasting impressions coming away from it, reading it again?
I think it's a very lighthearted, and the previous chapter was also on the positive side. He finally meets his guru. But you had those challenges that he had in Dayananda's ashram, and it feels like now Guruji is really excited about this new chapter of his life, and it starts out with this interesting, I think there's always this banter between him and his oldest brother Ananta, and this turns into a bet now that actually is really entertaining to unfold. So when I read this chapter, it became one of my favorites instantly because it was funny and interesting.
Yeah, it mixes such an important lesson, with a lot of fun, doesn't it? And that's sort of how it should be. Life, as Yogananda said himself, it should be, miraculous, a miracle after a miracle sort of thing. Following his footsteps here, we ended the first chapter. I'll pause before I jump into it. Priyank, do you want to come in?
Yeah, it's probably ended the last chapter. You were talking about, the footnote with Shankaracharya and the lineage of gurus, essentially. But one other thing that's surprising, you can miss it in this episode, in this chapter, is the fact that he meets a completely random person who knows that young Mukunda is his guru. So that is a very profound profound thing, and I'm looking forward to uncovering that, along with all the lighthearted things that you guys have always said.
It's a good point, well raised, actually. Is this the first time that somebody truly acknowledged Guruji as a guru? I think it is, yeah. And it's not one, but maybe two, as we'll find out. And there's a full 180 none other than his eldest brother. It's a juxtaposition from his previous rhetoric that he usually gives Mukunda. So it's fun to unpack this in a bit more detail. But some of the more kind of mundane elements, I do really enjoy thinking about this because, you know, I love to try to walk the mile in Guruji's shoes, and quite literally so. You know, if you try to follow his footsteps, we ended that he was in Aris or Varanasi, and he was told by Sri Yukteswar to go to Calcutta with some reluctance by Guruji, but he does agree to it eventually. And Jitendra then, it ended really last chapter with him saying, oh, I'm going to leave with you. And Guruji said, well, you know, there's a Christ-like saint in Serampore. And the two of them then go off together. And it was Jitendra really that suggests to Guruji to go to Agra. And it turns out that Guruji's brother, eldest brother Ananta, is actually stationed there with work. And so the two companions, then Guruji Mukunda and Jitendra, go to see the Taj Mahal. So they're making this big journey. And I threw into Google Maps, because it's so easy to do these days, 26 hours by car is the journey that the two companions took, which is no mean feat back some 100 years ago. I had to do by train and various other methods, I'm sure they took. And so that is a journey you're quite familiar with at the minute, Prank, and it's quite tough even today to do that.
Yeah. Indeed. I've done that journey.
So the two of them, Mukunda does actually, you know, nod to the length of the journey, the difficulty of the journey in the beginning of the chapter. We're going to unpack it here in a moment, but I just wanted to highlight that. But it's no, I'm sure it was no easy feat for them back in the day, which is interesting. And so they are in Brindaban, so they're heading to Brindaban from Agra. Mike, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just want to say, Priyank mentioned before we started recording how much better the roads in India are now than they must have been back in the day. Back in the day, this must have been going from one village to the next on dirt roads. And I'm sure now it's more like the nice experience on a freeway and stopping on a rest stop for a mango juice and things like that. Am I right?
Yes. But one thing that is still true today as well is they said that they were covered in dust later on in this chapter. My car that I'm borrowing off one of our friends who was on this podcast, the car every day is covered with dust. You wash it, next day is filthy. So like you have to wash it and wipe it every single day. Unlike obviously we're not used to that in Europe. Maybe some parts of US, Mike, we're used to that, but certainly not in Europe.
Yeah, I can say it's probably not too dissimilar to Brazil then. I've just given up in trying to keep that car clean. But these mundanes kind of add up. You know, I like to think about the rawness of the reality of living in this world and how we let the external world affect our mood so much. And Guruji talks about that a lot, you know, how to be always happy. You know, he talks about that. And these little things, being tired, being run down by big journeys, but yet being level, being still, you know, balanced internally, so important. So it's easy just to forget the context of what Guruji is literally doing, his whereabouts and his happenstance, and just take it that this is how he is always, but he really has to work at being so positive all the time. And it's a great, I think, personally, I take it as a good lesson. So we have then in the title, two penniless boys go to, in Brindaban. And Brindaban is a curious name then, because when you search it online, you don't get Brindaban, do you, Priyank? You get something slightly different.
You get Vrindavan.
Vrindavan.
With a V.
It's also Vrindaban. I've I see. Or Brindaban. It's spelled like three or four different ways from what I can
see.
Yeah,
so that's all down to the eastern states, like Bengal and Odisha. They like to, I don't know, for some reason, V's become B's. So Brindavan becomes Brindaban, or a hybrid Brindaban. But in the Sanskrit, it is Vrindavan.
Yes. Yeah. And this is a very holy and important city, holds very high religious importance. It's believed that Krishna spent most of his childhood days in the city. If the research that I did is indeed correct, it has about 5,500 temples dedicated to the worship of Krishna and his chief consort, Radha. So it would be a pretty nice place to visit, really. I'm sure it's seeped in spiritual significance, if that's that is indeed the case. And this is where the two boys, as Mukunda says, travel to. They weren't met with the most friendly of welcomes from what you can see in the first sentence of this chapter. I laughed when I read this. Because it was saying, you know, it would serve you right if Father disinherited you, Mukunda. How foolishly you are throwing away your life. And it's just a big kind of reality check, slap, you know, back to reality, back to the sort of banterish relationship that Mukunda had with his brother. You know, I fantasized the great reunitement of the two, sort of thing, where they would jump into each other's arms, and you know, there's no description of that, is there? It's just a, you know, Father should disown you. You know, what are you doing with your life? Straight away by the elder brother.
I think that Guruji mentioned before that's what he was afraid of. That's why he didn't want to leave Vrindavan. Varanasi. That's why he wanted to stay in the ashram, and also that's why he. When he met Sri Yukteswar, he was at first reluctant to tell him, yes, I'll move back in with my parents to come to your ashram. He was hoping he would have left the nest and not have to swoop back. And I guess Ananta would be the prime candidate for talking about this. I guess in an Indian family, that's kind of also his role, next to Mukunda's father, I think.
Chris, you mentioned light and jovial banter. In my take of it, I think it's, you know, this type of banter that people have, which is banter only on the surface. When you scratch beneath the surface, there's like some serious serious offense in there. Like Guruji, even like the words he uses later in this couple of paragraphs is, you know, assaulting his ears and barbed comments and things like that. So this is back to, you know, how family criticizes a family member who doesn't follow the same spiritual path or any spiritual path as you, and then they see you going a slightly different way and criticism. And oh, it's just I'm so used to it from my family, so I can sympathize.
Yeah, I think it's in its raw element, families tend not to swing their punches, so to speak, when they come to verbal exchanges. It can be quite difficult to hold your tongue. Guruji talks about this quite a lot, actually, in the sense that you first must try to master the relationships with your families, you know, with those in your family, that if you can make those harmonious. We can talk about this actually slightly later on in the in this episode, but it is of extreme importance, isn't it, to try to maintain that harmonious relationship and hold your tongue, and you know, maybe leave if it gets too heated, you know, in the family environments. But it is quite akin to the family environment, so maybe we're, you know, this is nothing unusual. Certainly Ananta was, as Mike, you were saying, he's playing a role of sorts as well, to try to, I read into it almost like it's a form of love, you know, twisted love logic, where you want Mukunda to be there with you. You don't want him to leave. You know, you want to have his presence with you and with the family, to keep the family together that way. So it's a form of not wanting to lose the love that he obviously, you know, has when he has Mukunda in his presence. So maybe there's a bit of that, but anywho, he does throw these assaulting remarks. He calls them an elder brother sermon was assaulting my ears, which I thought was just a really funny way to put it, very kind of lighthearted way to put it. And he continues with that sort of comedy where he says that it's a figure of speech when he was fresh from the train, Chitindran, he was fresh from the train, because they were actually covered in dust, as Pranik, you mentioned before. So it's quite a comical sort of couple of lines there. And so he mentions that the two of them, Chitindra and he, had arrived at the home of Ananta, and they had recently transferred from Calcutta to the ancient city of Agra. And this, you know, was quite a big distance for him to travel, as I mentioned. And possibly it's not quite clear, but maybe a coincidence that Ananta happened to be there, or Ananta happened to be there, and Jitendra said, well, why don't we go there and then visit Taj Mahal at the same time? But it doesn't really go into too much detail, but we're going to see that there's a comment by Mukunda as to why exactly they made their way to Agra, which is 25 plus hours from Calcutta, where Sri Yukteswar told them to go.
I think Ananta is probably a senior manager. And my uncle was a senior manager here in one of the a similar company, yeah, public company back in the day. And he would get moved around to cities like this as well. And they'd move the whole family. They'd give you a whole house, a car, everything, like just as Ananta is getting when you're at that senior or VP level. So I think he's obviously transferred. It says that he was a supervising accountant. So I think he's transferred on business. So that's why he's there. And happily, coincidence was that they wanted to go see the Taj Mahal anyway. So they got a free room and board at a family member's house.
Yeah. But it makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah, no coincidences, I suppose, makes sense. Mike?
I guess when you live in a touristy place like Agra, you will have a lot of friends suddenly who will want to visit you. that's kind of like what happened.
Mike, does that sound like you're speaking from experience, perhaps?
I mean, it is a bit like that when you live in a place like London as well.
No, not as much as LA, being the home of Guruji's stuff.
That too, yeah.
a bigger apartment. Yeah, every time I think about this, Priyank, I always think about you. Whenever the Public Works Department of Government is in Ananta working as the supervising accountant, but his father was working for the railroads, and we know Lahiri Mashai worked for the railroads. But I always think about yourself, Priyank. Was this an inspiration for you to work for?
Yeah, I think I mentioned it in the past. The railroads, noble profession, very little, karmic influences like defense or like animal agriculture or thing, you know, all these other things that may be a bit touchy morally.
Yeah, very nice. And Ananta, and he get into it immediately. So Mukunda and Ananta are talking, and we don't know, have they literally set foot off the train, or is this maybe a day later, or what this is, but Ananta waits for no one, and he says after Mukunda says, well, you know, Ananta, I seek my inheritance from the Heavenly Father, in response to Ananta saying that Father might disinherit you, Ananta then comes back to the retort to say that money first and God can come later. Who knows, life might be too long. And so that's quite a blunt thing to be saying to somebody like Mukunda, right? So it's a direct challenge. And indeed, Mukunda then rises to that challenge, and he says, no, God for money is his slave. Who can tell, life might be too short. And so it's a mirror image. You know, they're kind of pushing and prodding each other. barbing each other, but really there is a deep philosophical underlying to this, isn't there? But before we jump into it, Greg.
Yeah, just that philosophical underlying principle, i.e., and we've discussed it in the past, do you rely on your own capability to fend for yourself and put all of your eggs in that basket? Or do you, you know, give that maybe 10% and live 90% on God's will and desire? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and there's different parts of the autobiography that, you know, Guruji has said that, you know, if God has devised, you know, he sorts everything out, you know, puts food on the plate, and he puts, you know, houses the devotee, he'll see to it that this devotee gets taken care of in the end. So I think probably Master Maharsha said that as well or something. So he's suggested the latter approach a few times in the autobiography, isn't
it?
And who can tell, life may be too short, might have been also prophetic in this case, or intuitive. We know Ananta will have an early death. So maybe that was also not just something he just said as a retort, but also full of intuition.
Yeah, possibly. He did, Mukunda or Yogananda here, make the point to say that, you know, this retort to Ananta, whilst could have been seen as premonition, wasn't so, but it was simply due to the, you know, exigencies of the moment, as he says here, and held no kind of presentment. So possibly a little bit of both, but Yogananda did say that he didn't actually think of it at the time, essentially. He didn't actually feel like he knew anything. What I thought about when I read that last sentence was the power of word. And whenever Yogananda said to his sister about the boil, you know that story at the very beginning of the autobiography of Yogi, and his mother then took him to one side and said, you know, be careful about the words, that essentially they have power, because you don't want to misuse them. That popped into my mind whenever I read this. So I think it was sort of to say, look, I didn't have anything to do with it. You know, I didn't say anything that I shouldn't have in any sort of way.
Yeah, and there was a powerful message in that, because he was left with a scar, wasn't he, after that? And he said in the autobiography in that chapter one, he said, on my right forearm is a constant reminder of the power in man's sheer word. So I think he's suggesting he was very careful with his words after that, after that experience.
Yeah. There's a couple short readings, actually, maybe you guys could help us in terms of this philosophical underlying, you know, debate that the guys, you know, it's not even underlying, it's, you know, out in the open, isn't it, between the material, prioritizing material wealth over spiritual. Mike, could you read the first one?
Every fulfillment you ever dreamed of is waiting for you in God. The purpose of human life is not marriage and eating and death. To eat and drink and die is the way of the animals. Why live below your true station in life? God gave you intelligence that you might use it properly to solve the mystery of your existence. He made you intelligent that you might develop the discrimination to seek him.
Use this divine gift wisely. Not to do so is to do yourself the greatest possible injustice. You were not born merely to make money, have children, and then die. Yours is a glorious destiny. You are a child of the infinite. Every fulfillment you ever dreamed of lies waiting for you in God. His infinite treasure house is yours. Why delay? Why waste time on countless detours? Go straight to him.
Now, as Ananta quickly fires back in this passage to Mukunda, wisdom from the Hermitage, I suppose. But I see you have left Benares. That is probably what someone might say to just that reading, right? when it came to mind, I thought, yeah, that's exactly what somebody would say. Like,
yeah, Guruji says his eyes gleamed with satisfaction. So there isn't just the older, he was in the elder brother role and said what he had to say, but now you also can see there's some personal emotions going on as well, that he always felt, or that he can finally tell Mukunda, see, I was right. You should have done as I told you. And so there must have been quite a high moment for Ananta here.
Do you guys get pleasure from saying, see, I told you so?
You can't ask that question.
I mean, yes, and sort of term. That's the only truth of it. Like,
do you have to, have you guys tried? So the answer is yes, obviously. So have you tried to restrain yourselves? I've been doing that in the recent years, actually. Like, try and sympathize, or as opposed to, haha, told you so.
I mean, with family, you have to, right? Because with family, you know that you have to deal with them all the time, often. And I know a point that I score now, I might lose later on. So you have to choose your battles, right? So you have to be smart about those things. I think we all have those moments where we know, if I say this now, this might haunt me later.
So this is actually an interesting point you bring up, Mike, because I want to tie that into shortly. I want to come back to that point that you're making, Mike, about sort of a living experience teaching you something in a hopefully a good way, as you say. You know, from getting burnt enough times, maybe you don't want to continue that action, but it can work the other way. As I'll come back to that point. But yes, I think it is a rhetorical question, Prank, isn't it? Yeah, there's some pleasure in it, but there's little satisfaction. And that's something I've learned with my sister growing up, for sure. And the follow-up sentence then, that he's claiming satisfaction, it does say that he is yet hoping to secure my opinions in the family nest. So it's continuing that analogy from the previous chapter, the bird is swooping close to Calcutta. And this is sort of to my point earlier on, like the motivation for Ananta's seemingly harsh words might just simply be that he really wants Mukunda to stay, that he misses him. So it's interesting how that the close family bonds can maybe hold us back in the best intentions as well. So we've got to fight. We've got to try to clarify that and fight it when it happens.
I think those kind of comments are also covered by Guruji's definition of ahimsa. So he says that when you say something that disturbs the harmony in the room or between two people, even if it's temporary, then you are basically not following ahimsa. You are being aggressive, and that's something you shouldn't be doing. So it's a good training to, like, when Priyank asks, do you sometimes restrain yourself? It's probably most of the time, it's probably good to restrain yourself if you are on a spiritual path.
Yeah. And Mukunda, I don't know if he's doing that then in this sense, Mike, if he's taking advice, but he's still engaged with Ananta. He says that his sojourn in Benares was not in vain. I found there everything my heart had been longing for. And he's talking, of course, about Sri Yukteswar. And he makes a very funny comment here that he says, you may be sure that it was not your pundit or his son. Referencing the time when Ananta employed a couple, were they sadhus? I'm forgetting now, but to act as sadhus and advise Mukunda not to go down a certain path, certain spiritual path. And Mukund
Let's
is.
call him. Let's call him like a business sadhu or something. A sadhu who told him to go get a job instead of meditating.
He's got all the garm to practice. But, there's, you know, he picked up on it at the time, and then he remembers and he's calling Ananta out. But they have a good laugh about this. But Mike, jump in.
So Ananta says that, and he's gleaming, but I feel like he's not trying to be very hurtful. I would say it is. I guess in this situation, Mukunda kind of had this coming, and then Mukunda's retort. He's also not trying to hurt Ananta back. I feel like he's just defending his point of view, and he's mentioning the sadhu, like you said. But I feel like it's more like it's a respectful banter, I would say. It's not overly hurtful or aggressive.
Business sadhus is a good word, because I've been to quite a few important temples in the last few weeks, and a lot of them are run, not run, but there's lots of swamis that, how shall I say this, they try and coax you into doing various prayers and processes, and then they demand that you obviously donate to them afterwards. So you have to be very careful with what you accept, and they'll make it out like it's a custom, you know, you're stepping through this, so you have to do this. And obviously someone like us that have everything we need in our path, we know that no customs are required, but for others it's quite a cautious path you should take. But so that's one thing. The other thing is, I was in Dakshineshwar over New Year's, the ashram there, and one of the swamis gave a talk about this very topic, essentially defending yourself. So he was saying that you can, it's easy just to be quiet and to be meek and to just not fight, you know. It's the easy path, really, when you know, because then you don't firstly don't cause injury, you don't rile yourself up, you know, all that kind of stuff. But Swami made a really good point. He said, but if you don't fight back, then you're allowing the negative karma that the person who's doing essentially the wrong thing to accrue. So actually it's adharma, i.e. the wrong thing to do, not to defend yourself. So in this, he could very, very easily have just let Ananta just, you know, say what he wants to say, and Mukunda could have just smiled and just nodded along and, you know, laughed with him. But he fought back with virtually every single point that Ananta said. Mukunda fought back, and as we know, for the right reasons. So Swami's point is a good one for us in our lives as well. Doesn't, you know, just because it's a difficult to, you know, face someone that's challenging you, doesn't mean that you shouldn't. It's actually for their own benefit. And my wife actually did something quite cool as well recently. What was it? We were negotiating in a hotel for a room, and you have to negotiate with everything in India. And so he showed me a room, and then he came downstairs and he said, that's the price for that room, this is the price for that room. And my wife said, no, you told us this is the room we would be getting and this is the price. And he said, no, that was for the other room. So my wife took me to one side and said, so what do you want to do about this? And I was like, I shrugged my shoulders, so that, you know, I just let it, you know, let things take their natural course and just pay the extra or whatever. And she's like, no, I'm going to stay in the room that the price we agreed, even though it's a worse room, because he needs to learn the lesson about being true to his word. So we will suffer the consequences of staying in a worse room. But he will then hopefully realize that the impact of essentially lying. So she actually went, you know, laid into it about the, you know, the morality of being truthful and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it was really nice to see.
I think that's how civilization kind of etches forward, right? One small lesson at a time. It's just slow and painful, isn't it? As a whole. But what I think is how to master it is by keeping joyful internally. That's the really tough bit for me. How do you actually keep your peace and your calmness and your joy and have that not disturbed by engaging in something like that and actually not being influenced by that? That's the thing that really, for me, is the thing to work on. That's the mastery, being able to engage in the world in however it is that you need to, whilst maintaining the same joy that you get in meditation, right? Because it's easy to let that spill too quickly, no? On this subject, really, between the two of them, you know, the laughter that ensues after this comment from Guruji, and they reminisce, and you know, they're laughing, and Ananta has to admit, look, yeah, you know, that's he admitted to the clairvoyant not being a clairvoyant. He's more of a short-sighted one, as it says here in the text. The importance then of keeping harmony in the family is one that Yogananda talked about a lot, as we mentioned earlier on. Frank, would you be kind enough to read out the small quote from Guruji on this, on the subject?
Sure. So, the greatest of all happiness, next to divine happiness, is to be at peace with one's immediate relations, those with whom one must live with every day in the year. When people try to handle the extremely complicated machinery of human feelings without any training whatsoever, the consequent results are often disastrous. Very few persons realize that most of our happiness lies in the art of understanding the law of human behavior.
So here's Guruji, very familiar with his elder brother, and likewise his elder brother with Mukunda, with Guruji. They know exactly each other's behavior. They're able to push the boundaries, talk these ways. You know, they know each other's behavior. So it ends up in laughter. That's a great result, right? Even though they're making serious points and they're pushing each other, they end up in laughter. And so Ananta then turns and says to Mukunda, you know, what are your plans, my wandering brother? It's very affectionate, I thought. And Guruji then says Jitendra persuaded him to go to Agra to visit the Taj Mahal. And here we have the long journey from Calcutta out to Agra and onto Benares, as we'll soon find out. Priyank, want to jump in?
The beauties of the Taj Mahal, indeed. I've been twice now, and my wife came for the first time on this last occasion. And for me, like, the hype, it lives up to the hype. And I asked my wife, and she concurred. So highly recommend it.
No, it's on the bucket list if ever I get to go to India for a length of time. It's definitely up there. I do like, actually, you're doing the journey. You're almost following the journey that we're reading about in the autobiography of a yogi in real time. I think this is great. Was this a complete plan?
Yes, it was. It was inspired by this one and Dayamata's movie In His Footsteps. So I'm pretty much doing Dayamata's journey around India, really.
Nice. Well, we then see Guruji explaining this to Ananta as to why really they're up in that neck of the woods. It's quite far away from Calcutta, where Sri Yukteswar said for Guruji to go. He basically ordered Guruji to go. Ananta then is told by Mukunda that they're going to their newly found guru, or to Mukunda's newly found guru, to be precise. He has a hermitage in Serampore. And Ananta gets on with arranging the comfort for travel which was again very kind, doing that role of the elder brother, taking care of Mukunda. By the sounds of it, Mukunda isn't flush with his own money, but Ananda is working, is older, and has followed a different path, so he's taking care of Mukunda here. Mike?
Yeah, I think, of course, I think from the banter, you can also tell there's love between them, brotherly love, right? And I think as an oldest brother in an Indian family, you also see yourself as the family manager. So that's why he wants all of his siblings to do well and be successful. And so I think that's why they had this exchange earlier. But at the end of the day, he would support him in anything he does, I would think, or in most things that he would find useful or beneficial.
He's also, just the note, Jitendra is the sort of not the unsung hero in this in some way, but he's there, he's along for the journey. That's why I wanted to highlight how long a journey it was for the two of them to travel together. They would have been great friends and stuck together and had a spiritual bond. And Jitendra is there with him, influence him, you know, young Mukunda, where to go to see Taj Mahal, and has a part to play in the unfolding of the story.
I think Jitendra might also be taking advantage a little bit of the fact that Mukunda's brother has a apartment in Agra. I think in those days, India is a very big country and not everyone has probably seen it. So it might have been quite a momentous occasion for him as well to be able to see it. I remember I was in Peru last year and went with some friends, and we took all their family with us to Machu Picchu, and they had all lived there their whole lives and had never seen it because it is quite a journey and costs money. And so I guess in that sense, it might also have benefited Jitendra.
But remember, they're also both 18-year-olds, and Jitendra is 18 as well, probably. So they've got to, at that age, you've got to make the most of any hospitality for purpose of traveling.
Yeah, and so the two of them then are with enjoying the hospitality that Ananta arranged for them for their comfort. And a very curious line here, Guruji picks up on Ananta having his eyes fixed on him during the evening. And he was looking very reflective. And he said that, "I know that look." He thought, "I know that look." A plot. He recognized the behavior in his brother, that he was looking at him in very reflective, thoughtful ways, and he picks up on it. Greg.
I can concur with knowing this look, but on a slightly different note. As you guys know, I work for London Underground, and whenever I meet a new person and the conversation goes to, "What do you do?" And I say I work for London Underground, this similar thing happens, that Ananta has been, you know, the plot is brewing. A joke brews inside their head, and it's the same joke. It's the same joke that I've heard a trillion times. So I know that they're like what happens in people's eyes, but they're coming up with the joke. "Oh, so you're responsible for all my cancelled trains." I've just heard it so many times.
Least from me.
No, you're always simple. You want to know why it got cut. You always scratch beneath the surface, Mike. You always want to find a solution. But why does it have to be like that?
Let's sit down.
Why can't they do this? Why can't they do that? Just come and work for us, man.
I'm a transit nerd at heart. Yes.
That's it. Apply your passions, Mike.
His passions are unlimited, though. That's the problem, Mike.
Yeah, too many. Yeah. You have to focus on one. Cannot go after all of them.
Yeah, it's the eyes are the windows to the soul, I love that line. I don't know who said it or where it's famous from, but the eyes being the windows to the soul. I think it's a poem somewhere.
I think it was Chris Houston, I think, said it.
Yeah, 2004, right here first. Yeah, copyright.
You should write a book, Chris.
It is wonderful how true that is. You know, the eyes, we talk about the eyes with Guruji, you know, in many of his pictures, really, that they just are alive. And the transmuting of information and love and everything else, and it comes from the eyes, right? So it is very powerful. And so Guruji then notices this in Ananta, and he says, really, the denouement, I think it's a French word, the beginning of a sort of theatrical play took place at the early part of the breakfast. And here's Ananta throwing down the gauntlet, kind of challenging Mukunda to say that he's maybe enjoying a privileged life, saying that, so you feel quite independent of father's wealth. And Ananta's gaze was innocent. I love this. It was innocent as he resumed the barbs of yesterday's conversation. Made me laugh when I read that first. He never lets up, Ananta. Like,
yeah, that kind of confirms that a plot is brewing. Because that usually conflict is something that you do it, then you're done with it, and you don't bring it back, right? But he goes right back in there where they left off yesterday. So there's something going on.
Yeah. And Yogananda, straight back at it, retorts with, you know, I'm conscious of my dependence on God. And what I liked about this, actually, is he's not, you know, he could be saying a number of things here, really, but he's not denouncing that he has certain privileges in his life, and he's incredibly grateful for them. I imagine he is. He is rather focusing on the positive, which, as he says, he's dependent on God. It's a nicer way to come back to that retort, Mike, isn't it?
Yeah. So my retort would have been, come on, Ananta, we talked about this yesterday. Why do you bring this up again? But Guruji is really someone who does not evade conflict. He really answers, like, really profound. Like, what he says is very profound. So it's not deflecting in any way. So it must, I mean, Guruji is always ready to have a profound conversation on everything.
Yeah, but Ananda sort of lets him have it, sort of speak from his perspective, and says, words are cheap. You know, life has shielded you thus far. He really throws at him here. He says, what a plight if you were forced to look to the invisible hand for your food and shelter. You would soon be begging on the streets. And he really puts it to Mukunda here, and he gets a rise from Mukunda, and he says, never. You know, throws an exclamation mark there. So it's never. I would not put faith in passers-by rather than in God. I can devise for his devotee a thousand resources besides the begging bowl. It's quite strong words between the two of them, right?
Siblings really know, like, exactly what to do and say to get on each other's nerves, don't they?
Yeah.
Ananta is elite, professional.
Yeah, he's probably had plenty of practice over the years between the two of them. And Mukunda, really, young Guruji here, is really holding up them and speaking some truths. But Ananta doesn't let up, and he says, it's more rhetoric. Suppose I would suggest that your vaunted philosophy would be put to the test in this tangible world. So this sort of proposition, this bet is unfolding, and Mukunda walks right into Ananta's trap, so to speak, and he says, I would agree. You know, do you confine God to a speculative world? Mike?
This is where, like, you said, I feel like up to this point, there are many stories where someone goes and tempts a saint to do some miracle, right? And usually saints don't want to do that, because that's usually not the way to make people seek God. But it shows the unique relationship. If you are the brother of an avatar, you have certain privileges that other people don't have, and must be also immensely good karma to be in this situation. And so you might actually be in this family dynamic where you get your little avatar brother to actually agree to a bet like this.
The other thing I wanted to quickly mention was, you know, he essentially saying that he would never beg, you know, you never put faith in passers-by. But Brahmins, actually, one of the rites they have to undergo is to actually do begging, and it's called bhiksha. So they actually have to, it's actually part of the sadhana. They have to go and claim, you know, beg for alms and get you know, food and resources for the ashram that they belong to. So that's something that is done by, you know, lots of people. Even Krishna would have done it, actually, when he joined the ashram of Sandipani.
Wow, yeah. Is that, do you think, to promote humility and surrender?
Yeah, that's right. So you renounce your wealth, and hence you then rely 100% on God. And you know, in that, you have to obviously then rely on charity, because then you don't have a profession. But Brahmins obviously hold a very important role in the society in terms of, you know, spiritual unfoldment of the society, and conducting everything from weddings to christenings to, you know, funerals. So they're involved with all those things. So usually the Brahmins are very well taken care of by society.
That's interesting. I couldn't see Guruji in this world, in this incarnation, turning to that. And we're soon going to see in this chapter, often I was surprised by Guruji's interaction with people, that he pushed them away every time he met people, you know, in Benares, that potentially could have been a help, he was pushing them away. So he was actually doing quite the opposite, wasn't he? Which was, I find, very interesting. But Mike?
Yeah, Guruji was also very charismatic and very talented, a very talented organizer. So he didn't, I don't think the begging bowl is the most efficient way to get money, even in today's world. If you have the skills of, I think you would call it fundraising, where you have a, where you have a, you have some kind of event and you invite people with money and motivate them to donate money to you. And I think Mukunda is, in his time in India and also in America, very talented at this. So, man, it's not the same as the begging bowl, but it is very, I think the concept is similar.
Yeah, and later on, Frank, go ahead.
Finding angel investors, is it, Mike?
Spiritual VC. Yeah. I mean, Guruji later on, when he's in LA, the United States, shown how he could turn an investment through, I think it was real estate, was it not, investing in stocks and shares, and he was able to turn a profit on investing. And able to say, look, you know, this can be done, but let's not waste our energies on these things too much. So he later on did show that, you know, as and when you might need to, you can do through putting God first, not money first. So it does show that it can still be done on the other side of the fence, but with God, God is the priority. And Ananta here says, we shall see, and it sounds very ominous, doesn't it? We shall see. Today you shall have the opportunity either to enlarge or to confirm my own views. So he's thinking from his own perspective, Ananda, here, isn't he? He's trying to prove something to himself. And I thought, actually, this is quite a big change of rhetoric and approach from Ananda. Wouldn't you agree, guys? Because before, with Mukunda, his approach was shutting him down to try to pursue the spiritual life in a way that wasn't challenging him to go and prove it to him. He's not saying, go and prove it to me. He's previously, he was simply trying to put him off the path and not wanting him to run away and things like this. He was much younger, of course, but now he is actually going to engage him, going to try to challenge him. But interestingly, it is for his own views, for his own needs. It's not actually too much about Mukunda here. So we'll see maybe why that would be later on in the chapter. But Mike?
I made the same observation, and he doesn't treat it as a foregone conclusion that Mukunda is going to fail. So he lists both options as realistic, and he even says that it would enlarge his own view, which is, I think Ananda also has come a long way on this.
Yeah. Yeah, I think maybe it's of coming of age. You know, Mukunda is there. He's a young adult now, and he's clearly sticking to the path, making some good progress. He says he's met his guru, and maybe this is the point at which Ananda is thinking, wow, you know, maybe I'm the cusp of something here. Maybe I need to go along for the ride as well. So let's see how that develops. Priyank?
You don't think that Ananta is capable to have a very smooth way of manipulating, in the sense that he can leave a door open so it looks like he's, you know, willing to go down there, but his real intention is to, you know, prove Mukunda wrong, but he's just leaving this door open so Mukunda goes down that path.
I would agree with you, but I guess we know that how it ends. I guess we sort of know the punchline, don't we? We sort of know how.
But later he was really, really moved, wasn't he? If he considered it as a possibility, even now, that he could be wrong, you know, he wouldn't have been. He was so moved, wasn't he, when Mukunda came back and Jitendra confirmed the story. Obviously, we're going a bit ahead, but maybe we can remember this. Maybe we can remember this particular part of the conversation and reflect on it more later on.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to spoil the whole story, but maybe I'm starting to think that maybe the whole thing was a proud big brother, a plot that how a proud big brother gets to embrace his brother's spirituality without losing face.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's the elder big brother, like especially in India. Priyank, you've mentioned this about the hierarchical sort of structure and things like that, certainly that existed 100 years ago. So maybe it was that the stepping down of the, you know, of pride and being able to open the door himself to have that escape route. Possibly. It's nice to speculate on it. It's fun. But, you know, Ananta really throws down the gauntlet. If he didn't before, he's really thrown it down now. It's a proposition to Yogananda, and he says, Yogananda says, Ananta paused for a dramatic moment, and then he spoke slowly and seriously. I propose that I send you and your fellow disciple, Jitendra, this morning to the nearby city of Brindaban. You must not take a single rupee. You must not beg, either for food or money. You must not reveal your predicament to anyone. You must not go without your meals, and you must not be stranded in Brindaban. If you return to my bungalow before 12 o'clock tonight without having broken any rule of the test, I shall be the most astonished man in Agra. And so it's quite detailed, isn't it? And he's really thought it through. He's trying to close any loopholes. He's, you know, really trying to throw it on the challenge. And again, it's to be sure in his own mind that if this was to succeed, there may not be any interpretation of it. You know, it could be agreed mutually that, you know, the invisible hand was at work. So he's thought it through probably more for himself in this instance. Brent?
What a good accountant he must be if he can think to this level of detail. You know, accountants are detail oriented people, aren't they? But this, he's used his all his skills to manipulate a scenario here where it seems like it's virtually impossible for Mukunda to win unless God really is helping him.
Yeah, I liked as well, it seems like a verbal contract to me that Mukunda then sort of shoots back and says, you know, I accept the challenge and there's no hesitation in my words or in my heart. And he states it quite simply there for us. There isn't no hesitation was in my words or in my heart. And there's a great lesson in that as well, isn't it? What we talked about before, strength in words and the importance of words. And we see that in how Ananta slowly and, you know, quite seriously spoke and took that dramatic moment to sort of set it out in verbal contract for the two of them. And yeah, he didn't rush, did he, Prank? He did take his time, yeah, had patience, probably thought through, well, actually, this might not work if he's allowed to do X or Y. And he sort of put, you know, he did his due diligence before putting proposition to him, it seems. Mike?
Yeah, when the fact that he didn't hesitate at all probably kind of means that the divine in him is also ready for this challenge and saying, yeah, let's do it. Let's show him. He needs to see this. That is possible.
What do you think, Brank? If we, Mike and I, challenge you today and give you these stipulations that you couldn't beg, you couldn't ask for money, you couldn't tell anybody about your predicament, you couldn't go without meals.
But you can fundraise. You can do a PowerPoint presentation.
Spiritual BC. Would you do it? Would there be any hesitation, Brank, in your work?
Mark? Well, put it in writing and I'll get my people to look at it.
I'll have my lawyer look at it.
Okay. Might hold it to it. We'll see. So grateful memories, Mukunda says, and this is such a lovely paragraph, you know, he brings up essentially all the miraculous moments in his life to date, or many of them anyway, that we've been, that he's shared with us. That is lovely to reflect on. And he says that memories flashed in of the instant beneficence and his heart, his healing of deadly cholera, of course, that he was healed by Lahiri Mahashaya and praying to that picture of Lahiri Mahashaya. The playful gift of the two kites on the Lahore roof, when he was calling them over to him with his sister. That was a nice moment as well. And the opportune amulet amidst his discouragement in Bareilly. And the decisive message through the sadhu outside the courtyard of the pundit's house in Benares. And he goes on to talk about more of them with divine mother and her majestic words of love, the swift heed through the master of Mahasaya to the trifling embarrassments, last-minute guidance that had materialized in his high school diploma. We've covered all of these, haven't we? He's reflecting on all of them. And the ultimate boon, of course, the meeting of the Swami Sri Yukteswar, midst of the lifelong dream. So he's reflecting on all these serendipitous moments, of all the moments of, I guess, reinforcements of faith. And he's essentially saying these are the foundations for me as to why I was able to just say yes without any hesitation. like?
And there are different categories of help that he got there from the infinite. The healing of cholera, for example, that is very serious, life-threatening. Getting the kite is more like, it was like, it's similar to this situation now. It's like a bet with a sibling. I mean, back then they were much younger, but it is, when I think of those miracles by saints, I feel like most of them, they only were happy to do them when it was serious and about something. And I feel this might be serious in the sense that it establishes Mukunda's role in the family better. It maybe puts this thing that Mukunda should not be a monk to bed forever, this kind of episode. It's a theory, at least.
Which of all these categories and all these circumstances is your favorite thus far, boys?
Interesting question, yeah. Mike?
For me, it's the sadhu. The sadhu, because that was his lifelong goal, and getting this amulet is great. It's just if someone would write a book, a fantasy book, I mean, he couldn't write it any better. And the fact that his mother wasn't giving it to him directly, but a year after her passing, and it even got delayed, and then it vanished. So I think that's my favorite.
So you decline the vision of the Divine Mother for an amulet.
Yeah, I'm now in the perspective of a reader of a book. So I found this the most intriguing. Of course, if it's personally me, I would probably prefer an experience.
My take on this would be the first one, the healing of the deadly cholera through the appeal to Leary Vaishya's picture, because his mother was there for that, right? And his mother was really a conduit for that through her devotion. You know, she was encouraging that. And I think for the two of them to have had that experience would have been extremely bonding and reinforcing of not only his faith and ability to get be healed, but also of his mother's. And it would have had that dual meaning. And imagine, you know, in your sort of darkest moment, it was a life-threatening moment, really. That's really, really dangerous issue that he was dealing with, in deadly cholera. What that would have done to your faith to be saved just like that at that time.
Wasn't there a dual miracle in that? It's also because his mother asked him to look at the picture of Lahiri Maharshi. And so the dual miracle was getting healed, but also Lahiri Maharshi through a picture healing him. So that's quite nice. My favorite amongst this list is my living master from midst of my lifelong dreams being the ultimate boon. So if I went through all of those experiences, but the last one with Sri Yukteswar, that is creme de la creme.
Yeah. Hats off. Yeah, I would agree. It would all be rather frustrating if that last one didn't materialize when he thought it would. What actually, just to look back to something I said at the beginning of the podcast, was about experiences in life and either reinforcing behavior to the good or bad. And in this instance here, we have Mukunda saying that there was no hesitation in his words or heart, that he accepted the challenge, which was essentially to say, yeah, God is with me. You know, God will take care of me in this on this trip to Brindaband. He's saying in the next sentence that the grateful memories flashed of the instance of X, Y, and Z, and all of the amazing miracles and happenings that he had in his lifetime that reinforced his belief and faith and strengthened him. So would the absence of that do the opposite for us? And maybe is this something that we need in order to have faith? And maybe thirdly, do they happen all the time? We're just not aware of them for him?
Some pretty deep questions there, Chris, to spring up on someone. Thankfully, the talk today, Brother Swami gave just now, actually, I just came out of a talk, and he, every Sunday here, there's a satsang led by one of the monastics, and the talk was on faith, actually, and he was talking about how poor the word faith is as a translation for the Sanskrit word, which is vishwas. Vishwas, he translated it, would you believe, there's two words, svas, which means breath, and vish, which is without. So it's essentially the faith that would, is the translation is being breathless, essentially, being secure in the breathless state. That's the infinite, you know, the highest level of faith. But if I had, you know, when you were challenging me, Chris, to something similar to what Ananta has, you know, done for Mukunda, and obviously you said it as a joke or in jest, but because I haven't gone through all these things that Mukunda has gone through, my vishwas is nowhere near at the level of Mukunda, right? So I would definitely get my people to look at what the proposal you've put, and most likely there would definitely be hesitation in agreeing to something as outlandish as this. So because I haven't had the beautiful experiences that Mukunda has to have such a strong faith in vishwas.
I feel those experiences, they also, I would say the God, when they happen and there is the right attitude towards them, then they become very important in someone's life. And then if the attitude is wrong, then they might just be something that happened and had no effect at all, and I don't think God is then like makes things here, miracles happen on and on again to keep the faith alive, right? I feel like that's it's more like a tool to kind of awaken faith and then see if it's self-sustaining. And that's why when anything miraculous happens in your life where you feel like Guruji really helped you, then I think this is a memory we should always keep and always be grateful for and ride on it as long as we can, so to speak.
The start of the last chapter was faith in God can produce any miracle except one, passing an examination without study. So faith was in there. And he's put this as one of the examples that the grateful memories that he's had of the instant beneficence. And this specific example Swamiji led with today in the talk about Vishwas, and he talked about a very personal example. And I'm sure he won't mind me sharing it. He said, just a few weeks ago, he said, a very poor boy, from a very poor family, wanted to study in one of the premier institutions in this country for technology, but he obviously didn't have the financial means and all that kind of stuff. But he's a member, right? And he knows that he's a very, you know, he knows of him, and he's met him a couple of times. And so he thought, let me see what I can do for this boy. You know, it just came to him that I might be able to help him. So he made a few calls, and then one of his contacts said, you know, because you've called me and you've asked me, leave this to me. I'll put him in my college and he'll, you know, he'll have it passed to this goal, the other. So essentially, without, you know, without any trying, this boy managed to get to where he wanted to be, which is quite a miraculous thing. Then he said he reflected on it, and he thought, let me look into this, because this rarely happens, that someone comes with quite a challenge and instantly gets the reward of you know, faith. And he looked into it, and he'd actually met this boy when he was, I think, 12, he said, when he was very young. And he didn't say 12, actually. He was much, much younger, essentially. And he'd come to the ashram in Ranchi, and he was, the Swami was there serving, and he'd come to the ashram 2 days before his exam. And the boy said, you know, I've got a very important exam, Swamiji. Can you pray that that they go well? And Swamiji said, yes, of course, I'll pray. You go into Master's room and pray to Master for him to help. He'll surely help you. And then he did that. And then a day or two later, 2 days later, actually, he phoned Swami, saying, Swamiji, what I didn't tell you that day was that on the way to coming to see the ashram to take blessings from Master and yourself, I actually fell from my bike, and both my hands were so badly mangled that I could barely even hold a pen. So I didn't tell you this, but this is what had happened. And he said, but because you told me to essentially go pray to Master, I did that. And even at the school, when I sat the exam, they offered me the help to, what's it called, to go sit in an exam where someone writes for you, you just dictate. And he said, no, I want to do it. I want to do it as, you know, God and Gurus have put me in the position, so I'm going to do it. So his faith was so strong that not only 2 days before the exam did he go to the ashram to seek Guruji's blessings, but he was so injured, he didn't say anything to Swami. And then he went through this and he got something like 80%. So he was saying that, Swamiji was saying that faith builds faith. So it wasn't that when he came to him just now to put him into the, you know, the college, it was actually all his past karmic efforts in developing faith that got him to the result, which so easily, it looks like it happened so easily, but look at how much striving and struggle that he's gone to in the past to build his faith, which was a really, really lovely story.
Yeah, really, really nice story. Thanks for sharing that. And there's maybe another element to this as well, and Guruji's touches on it here, where he says, never would I admit my philosophy unequal to any tussle on the world's harsh proving grounds. Such a great line. I love that, because it's this ironclad will, this willingness. And Ananta picks up on it and says, your willingness does you credit. And so the willingness and faith, this mix, is really potent, isn't it? Because not only, don't know how you would actually separate the two in this sense, but not only is he filled with faith, and you know, he's brimming with faith, he's actually willing to go through with any sort of challenges and struggles that might actually come from it. He's actually willing to go into that wholeheartedly, and that is a very, very powerful mix. So that's a really nice way to follow up with it, Mike.
I wonder if Ananta was taken aback by Guruji's determination to say yes right away and just go for it and let's go to the train station. Because he might have thought, maybe this is just crazy. Why would anyone do that to themselves? And he also, earlier he said that Mukunda grew up very privileged, and so I will show you that life is actually tough. And but then he does not back down from this challenge at all. He just goes for it. So might have been a surprise for Nanta as well.
I think Ananta is used to Mukunda's, indefatigable zeal for the divine from, the earliest age, with the story of the kites, and, Ananta would have heard about all of these, things that Mukunda is going through. So, but it's got to the stage now where I think, Ananta actually has essentially the best intentions, doesn't he, for his brother. But he's got to the stage where he's 18, in Ananta's mind, he's 18 now. He's literally throwing his life away. This is Ananta's impression, right? So he's raising the stakes for everything, not just for Mukunda, but for himself as well, because he's putting his reputation and what course he takes forward. So it actually shows quite a lot of humility and selflessness on Ananda's part, doesn't it?
It's a tough challenge, though, I would say. So if Mukunda's mother was still alive, what would she say to this exchange? She would probably not let this happen. But yeah, you're right. I mean, on the one hand, it's Ananta being more open-minded, but it's also sending him, an 18-year-old, to a city he's never been to without any money, which is a tough challenge.
Yeah, his mother would definitely not agree. But yeah. men, this is what we do.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. We can all relate to it, I suppose. The fun, the challenge of it, the danger of it as well. It does come some question marks, no doubt. But to add to the sort of love and empathy towards Ananta, here's Mukunda saying that the philosophy, he would never admit that the philosophy unequal to any tussle of the world's harsh proving grounds. Here we have Ananta, elder son in a large family, and the mother dying quite young, when he was quite young. And so the responsibility on his shoulders would have been quite significant. And this might be the world's harsh proving grounds that you could say Mukunda's partly talking about. That's now these philosophies are coming up against each other. They're clashing. Because here's Ananta saying, look, here's my reality. Money comes first. We have to be able to provide and, be responsible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And here's young Mukunda saying, actually, no, this is not the right way to be. We must be a different way. But there's Ananta doing his best. He's trying to challenge his own philosophy, his own set of understanding of how to go about in the world. And he had that foisted on him by society and so on to some degree, right? So to credit to Ananta, he's throwing this gauntlet down. Mukunda's picked it up quite happily and said, yep, I'll take your challenge. And Ananta wastes no time, and immediately he says, I'll escort you to the train at once, Ananta says. So no time to deliberate. We're not doing this tomorrow, it's today. He turned to the open-mouthed Jitendra. This made me laugh when I read this. Her Jitendra hasn't said a word in this conversation that we know of. and now Ananta's turning to him. You must go along as a witness, very likely as a fellow victim. So he's
he just
throwing
wanted to see the Taj Mahal, didn't he, poor chap?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He was going to see a Christ-like saint and a nice beautiful architecture, but he's now going for the challenge of his life. And I thought, as a way of analogy of sorts, it's like the tale of the little self and the big self. The little self, the little ego struggling against the reality. And we're going to see how much Jitendra really fights Mukunda on this, really challenges Mukunda about, are they doing the right thing and so on and so forth. And that's like the ego. We're gonna unpack that in the next episode, constantly sort of challenging us and darting us our actions, and the soul, the higher self, is wanting to act boundless and limitless, which is what Mukunda is exemplifying right now in his actions, and young Jitendra is getting going along for the ride. He's tagging along. I don't think he has much of a choice at this point in time. But we talked about it before, I think a couple episodes ago, at least about friendship and the importance of friendship. It is, you know, pretty important subject. So there's a couple of short readings. Priyanka, Mike, be kind enough to sort of close us off on this episode and read these, and then we can do a short recap for saying goodbye. So Priyanka, could you read the first quote, Paramahansa's quote on friendship? Sure.
The treasure of friendship is your richest possession because it goes with you beyond this life. All the true friends you have made, you will meet again in the home of the Father. For real love is never lost.
Divine love recognizes all good persons who enter our lives as expressions of God's love for us. Every friend in the guise of relatives, friends, beloved, spouse, who is with us now or who has left this earth, is a medium through which God himself symbolizes his friendship. To ignore or abuse friendship, therefore, is an affront to God.
Awesome. So there we have it, the importance of friendship. We have Jitendra then going along as a witness, and we'll jump into it in the next episode as to how that all unfolds. But for now, chaps, anything you want to say before we round off this episode?
Yeah, quick one. My friends, when they were in university, they had a similar challenge to this. They had this thing where a corporate sponsor to their course said, okay, we'll agree to give to your charity, but we'll give you a challenge, they said. We'll match pound for pound every mile you can travel for free. So you have to show that you went for free, i.e. a receipt that says £0. And then we'll transfer that amount to the charity that you're raising for. So they took on this challenge and they convinced lots of different companies and lots of different buses, lots of different planes, and ended up on 7 different flights all the way down to South America and raised like £20,000. So faith, right? And the right to means. But on that topic, I thought I'd just, whilst I can get kicked out now because we're nearly finished. So here I'm in the book room in Dwarahat Ashram. Yeah. It's next to 0 degrees. So hence I'm pretty wrapped up, nearly freezing here.
Well, stay warm. Be with us for the next episode, Priyank. And you're seeing Babaji's cave tomorrow, I believe you said.
Yes.
Awesome. Awesome. So
all the best there.
You can tell us a little bit more about that.
Hopefully you're watching my little vlogs that I'm keeping everyone updated on.
Yeah, they're great. They're really, really good so far. Yeah. I'm enjoying the live sort of element. you were just talking about how people pray at the door of, is it the Hiri Mahashaya's?
The Hiri Mahashaya, yeah.
Somebody showed up and did just that,
right? Yeah. Yeah. That was awesome.
Yeah. Keep them coming. So thank you very much, Jaguru, everybody.
Thank you, Chris.
Jaguru.